Hear your voice from the unloading shed. You're exactly right, Tashi. We've got a couple of them working already. Joris Voorhoost wouldn't listen to any objections. He wanted food, decent Sri Lankan food, and if they didn't want to eat, they could just watch him doing so. Because it turned out he had been 5 weeks on the Skyhook himself and was just now coming back from supervising the work of those very spacecraft whose existence Natasha had deduced. "Skyhook is really beginning to pull its weight," he informed them happily. The two robot rocket ships that were already commissioned were working as scavengers, dedicated to combing Leo for abandoned spacecraft or even abandoned fuel tanks of ancient Russian and American ones. Once found, computer-controlled solar sails were mounted on them, and they were programmed to sail themselves to Grand Central. There they were transformed. They were no longer dangerous, free-flying spaceship killers. Now they were simply the raw materials for anything that needed to be built. "It's all very well to ship stuff up from the surface," Voorhoost declared, mouthful of what even Myra had to admit was a really good curry. "But why should we waste what's up there already?" "And that's what you were doing up in Leo, collecting scrap to build new things?" Voorhoost looked embarrassed. "Actually," he said, "I was making sure the third ship was ready to go. That's the one that's headed for the moon. You know that the robot explorers have been busy there for a few years now? And they've found plenty of those lava tubes I used to talk about in my astronomy class?" "Actually," Ranjit complained, "I didn't. The progress reports they sent the advisory council were pretty sketchy." "Yes," Voorhoost conceded, "I know they were. We're hoping the big three will loosen up a little now because those tubes are going to change everything. One of them is right under the Sinus Iridium, the Bay of Rainbows. It's a beaut. It's 1,800 meters long. And Ship 3 will be carrying the machinery to seal it up because Lunar Development has a plan for it. The big three want tourists, you see." Myra looked skeptical. "Tourists? Last I heard, there were about 11 people living in the lunar colony, and it was costing a fortune just to keep them fed and supplied with air to breathe." Voorhoost grinned. "In the old days, yes, that was when they had to be supported from Earth's surface by rockets. But now we've got the Skyhook. Oh, there'll be tourists, all right. And to give them a good reason to go there, the big three pulled a few strings, and now the Olympics Association has made a deal." Natasha, previously uncharacteristically silent, perked up. "What kind of a deal?" "To hold the kind of events they can't do on Earth, Tashi. You see, lunar gravity is only 1.622 meters per second squared, so..." Natasha held up her hands. "Please, Dr. Voorhoost." "Well, it's just about 1/6 as much as Earth's at the surface. That means that the minute anybody does competitive sports on the moon, all the old records that involve running or jumping are just out the window. I'm not sure that even the Sinus Iridium tube is tall enough to let the high jumpers strut their stuff." Ranjit was looking skeptical. "You think people are going to travel a couple of 100,000 kilometers just to watch some athletes jump high?"
"I do," Voorhoost insisted. "So does Lunar Development. But that's not the star turn. What would you say to a contest that hasn't been possible on Earth, like a race between humans in muscle-powered flight?"
If he expected Ranjit to answer, he was disappointed. There was a crash of dishes as Natasha jumped to her feet.
"I would say I'm ready," she cried. "I want to go. And you'll see, I'll win."
Chapter 32 Natasha's Gold. She did go there, too. Not immediately, of course. A lot had to be done before that first ever Lunar Olympics could be held. A lot done to the moon to make it possible, for example, and a quite large lot that had to be done to the Skyhook to at least make it possible to carry passengers with a reasonable hope that they would get there alive. Now that the briefing texts had become more informative, Ranjit devoured them as soon as they arrived, all the space cadet fever that Joris Voorhoost had awakened in him flashing back. Fortunately for Ranjit's peace of mind, the world seemed to have taken a turn for the better. The second dose of silent thunder had restrained some of the unruliest of the world's leaders. His seminars kept going well enough to keep Dr. Davoud Boy pleased,
and his little family continued to be an unfailing delight. Especially Natasha. The prospect of college looming just a few years before her was no problem, but there was also the Lunar Olympics Dr. Voholst had promised. Training for that was not easy. It made the athlete's training for every other Olympics look like 10 minutes of morning jumping jacks to keep the love handles away. Of course, Natasha was not the only one training for that unprecedented match. All over the world, young athletes were wondering if they could get themselves fit enough for the flying events. Since the task of training would have to be accomplished within the tyranny of Earth's uncompromising 1G gravity, a good deal of ingenuity was going to be required. There were two lines of approach to the problem of muscle-powered flight. The balloonatics believed in employing gas bags of various shapes so that the athlete was supported in flight, using all his muscle power to crank a propeller without the need of expending any effort simply to stay aloft. The skybikers, on the other hand, preferred to do everything by their muscles alone. For them, sporting goods manufacturers had rapidly invented a whole array of propeller-driven devices. Thanks to carbon-60 nanotubes, the same molecules that made the skyhook a working means of transportation instead of an idle dream, these devices were so light that even on Earth they could be lifted with one hand, on the moon with a single finger. What none of these ambitious athletes had was a true 1/6 gravity practice arena. They had to do the best they could, usually by using equipment counterweighted to give the equivalent of lunar gravity, all of which meant that it was not only ingenuity that was called for, also required was quite a lot of money. That would have exceeded the purchasing capacity of a college professor by a considerable margin, but for those purposes, Natasha's needs got considerable support from Sri Lankans in high places. Even those who had no particular interest in sporting events enjoyed calling attention to the fact that Sri Lanka had become the world's doorway to space. So the money was pledged, and a great lunar gravity gym was built on the outskirts of Colombo. There Natasha practiced skybiking to her heart's content. The gym was only a 10-minute drive from their home, and so Natasha's family were often present as spectators, sometimes more than spectators. Robert loved watching his big sister pump her way across the sky of the gym, loved even more when at last there was a little bit of open time on the machines. Then Robert, too, got his chance to fly. Of course, it was not only Natasha who was given the use of the low-grav gym. Hopeful candidates from all over the island begged for the chance to try their own skills on the machines, and more than 30 of them won the opportunity. But it was Natasha Subramanian who consistently outperformed every challenger. And on the day when the Sri Lankan team at last assembled at the Skyhook terminal to be elevated to their first experience of space, it was Natasha who carried the island's hope of victory. When Myra got a look at the prices the tour companies were advertising for the Lunar Olympics, she gasped. "Oh, Ranjit," she moaned, one hand pressed to her heart. "We can't let Tashi fly that race without us there. But how can we go?" Ranjit, who had been expecting no less, was quick to reassure her. Families of contestants received a substantial discount. So did members of the advisory board, himself included. And when you put the two discounts together, the cost of the tickets was no more than outrageous. Not impossible, though. Accordingly, Myra, Ranjit, and young Robert presented themselves at the terminal. Like everybody else in the world who owned a telescreen, which to a close approximation was pretty much everybody in the world, they had seen the rapturous news stories that had accompanied the Skyhook's evolution to passenger carrying. They knew how the passenger capsules worked and what it would feel like to be borne skyward at a steady rate of meters per second. What they had not entirely appreciated, though, was quite how many seconds, even at that speed, it was going to take to get from Sri Lanka to the Sinus Iridium. This was not a weekend trip. In the first half-dozen days, they had got only as far as the lower Van Allen belt when the Subramanians, along with other families aboard, namely the Kais, the Kospas, and the unpronounceably named Norwegians, had to hustle into shelter against the murderous Van Allen radiation. The shelter consisted of the triple-walled sleep and sanitation chambers of the capsule. Those contained the toilets, the laughably named baths, and 20, count 'em, 20, extraordinarily narrow bunks arrayed in ranks of 5. When you had to head for the shelter, what you brought with you was the skimpy skyhook special garments you were wearing, nearly weightless to save on load, and as close to unsoilable as fabric technology could make them, since there was no hope of laundry. Your medications, if any, and yourself. You could bring nothing else. Least of all, modesty. Robert didn't care for the shelter. He cried. So did the Kai grandson. Ranjit didn't much care for it either. When he was in the shelter, he yearned for the greater, though minimal, freedom of the unsheltered capsule, with its dark corners and its exercise elastics and its windows, long, narrow, and thick ones, but still rewardingly transparent. And most of all, he yearned for their regular bunks that had their own lights and their own screens, and almost as much space to turn around in as an average coffin. Enough, indeed, to allow for having company in them now and then, provided you were on extremely intimate terms with the company. That first sentence to shelter was only for 4 days. Then they were in clear space again, for another 9 days, until the warning squeals went off once more, and it was time to seek shelter from the upper Van Allen. Space travel had become possible for almost anyone. It certainly had not become easy, though. Or, come to that, particularly pleasant. A funny thing happened as they came out of the upper Van Allen. Robert had made a dash for his favorite spot, the 2-meter-long ribbon of thick plastic that was their main window to the universe outside. Myra was already climbing into the exercise straps, and Ranjit was considering heading for his personal bunk and some untroubled sleep, when Robert came bouncing back to them, shrieking in excitement. Excited Robert was even harder to understand than the relaxed one. All either Myra or Ranjit could make out was the one word, fish. Robert could not, or would not, do much in the way of clarifying, and there was no Natasha on hand to translate. What there was the 3-year-old girl who had come with one of the other families in their capsule. She listened silently to their talk for a moment, and then, still silent, took Robert away to learn how to do what Myra recognized as Tai Chi. That was little Luo, daughter of the couple from Taipei, who were one fragment of their fellow passengers in the capsule. There were 6 of the Kais in all, including the elderly mothers of both Mr. and Mrs. Kai, who were in the hotel business. This had made them filthy rich, as they needed to be, to afford being among the first of the actual tourists the Olympics people were counting on. So were the family from South Korea, so also the young couple from Kazakhstan. The Norwegians weren't, particularly. But they were the parents and siblings of one of their nation's broad jumpers and thus were entitled to the discounted fare. What was wrong with the 17 other human beings who shared their capsule was that not one of them spoke English, much less either Tamil or Sinhalese. The younger Mrs. Kai was fluent in French, so Myra had someone to talk to. The others talked to each other in Russian, Chinese, and what Ranjit thought was probably German, none of which were of much use to him. Not at first, anyway. But what they had a lot of was time. Weeks to the midpoint, weeks more to the far end where their capsule was whipped off on its lunar trajectory, and then a day or two more until their landing at Sinus Iridium. It was during that last lap when the Subramanians were never more than a few steps from the news screens, because that was when the eliminations were taking place on the moon. The final race would be mano a mano, just one winged flyer against one balloonist. 7 wingers had made the trip to take part in the trials, and as the Subramanians were coming up on the end of their last flight, Luna itself hanging gigantic out their windows, they heard their daughter announced as the winner of the trials. By then, all of the adults had become capable of speaking at least a few words each of all their home languages, and they used them to congratulate the Subramanians. Natasha met her family at the elevator from the surface to the Olympic Village, talkative, happy, and Ranjit was a bit surprised to find, accompanied by a tall, coffee-colored young man from Brazil. Both wore the minimal garments that everyone wore in an environment that never altered much from 23 degrees centigrade. "This is Ron," she told her parents. "That's short for Ronaldinho. He's 100-meter dash." It wasn't until Ranjit made the experiment of trying to see his daughter through the eyes of Ronaldinho from Brazil that he really noticed how much a 15-year-old girl could resemble an attractive adult woman. To his surprise, Myra did not seem perturbed. She shook this Ronaldinho's hand with apparently genuine warmth, while young Robert took notice of the runner only to shove him out of the way as, roaring, he threw himself into the arms of his big sister. After covering the top of Robert's head with kisses, Natasha said something in Ron's ear. He nodded, said to her parents, "It is pleasing to meet you," and disappeared, loping in the slow-motion, stretched-out walk that the lunar gravity encouraged. "He's got to practice," Natasha said. "My own race is tomorrow, but his isn't till Wednesday. He'll get your bags and put them in your room, so we can get you something decent to eat." Holding Robert by the hand, she led the way. With Natasha's help, the child quickly learned a decent approximation of Ron's gait. Ranjit was less fortunate. He found it was easier, if less graceful, to execute a slow-motion hop from point to point. They didn't have far to go, and it was worth their while when they got there. The food was as unlike the extruded fodder of the Skyhook capsule as anyone could have hoped for. A salad, some kind of meat, perhaps ham, chopped and molded into croquettes, fresh fruit for dessert. Most of it shipped up from Earth, Natasha told them, although the strawberries and most of the salad stuff are grown in another tube. It wasn't the food they wanted to hear about. It was what Natasha had been doing and how she felt. What Natasha wanted was to hear all about their trip, listening with the somewhat amused patience of the veteran who had done all those things herself already. She paid attention when they told her about Robert's shrieking the word fish, although when she queried Robert himself about it in their own personal dialect, he was more interested in his shortcake than giving her answers. "He just says he saw something out the window that looked like a fish. Funny, some of the other people here said they saw something on the way up, too." Myra yawned. "Probably frozen astronaut urine," she said drowsily. "Remember those stories about the Apollo crews seeing what they thought were space fireflies? Anyway, did you say we had a room with a real bed?" Natasha had said it, and they did have it. Not just any bed either, but a bed that was more than 90 centimeters across, which meant plenty of room for Myra and Ranjit to cuddle up. As soon as they saw it, they couldn't resist it. "Just a nap," Ranjit told himself, one arm around his wife, who was asleep already. "Then I'll get up and explore this fascinating place. Oh, I mean after I take one of those real showers." That was his definite intention. It wasn't his fault that when he woke, it was with his wife gently shaking his shoulder and saying, "Ranj, do you know you slept for 14 hours? If you get up now, you'll have time for a decent breakfast and a look round the tube before we have to get to the race." Some Olympic events have been witnessed by crowds in the hundreds of thousands. The in-person audience at these first lunar games, by comparison, was almost invisibly tiny. There were just enough people to fill the 1,800 lightweight seats that climbed the walls of the tube, and the Subramanians were lucky enough to have their seats less than 100 meters from the finish line. By the time they made their way to them along the footwalk, Ranjit was feeling about as good as he ever had in his life. A good long sleep, a quick shower in real, if reprocessed, water. Only 30 seconds of the spray by its timer, but you could get really wet in 30 seconds. And a quick look around had marked the beginning of a good day. He was surprised to find that the living quarters weren't in the giant stadium tube itself, but in a smaller one nearby, connected by a man-made tunnel. But he was there, on the moon, with his dearly beloved wife and son, and on what might be his dearly beloved daughter's happiest day ever. Although the man-made atmosphere in the tunnels was at only about half the pressure of sea-level Earth, it had been considerably oxygen-enriched. That was more important to the balloonatic who was Natasha's opponent, Piper Dugan, than to herself, although in the moon's 1/6 gravity he still needed a capacity of less than 30 cubic meters of hydrogen to lift him. He was, as it happened, Australian. As he entered with three assistants on the ropes to make sure the machine didn't get away, his streamlined hydrogen cylinder floated overhead. As Dugan entered, an invisible orchestra played what the program told Ranjit was Australia's national anthem, Advance Australia Fair, and most of the audience on the far side of the tube went mad. "Uh-oh," Myra whispered into Ranjit's ear. "I don't think there are enough Sri Lankans here to equal that for Tashi." There weren't, to be sure, but there was a big contingent from next door India, and an even bigger one from people of any nationality who just happened to give their affection to a young girl from a tiny island. When Natasha came in to take her place, she had her own single assistant, this one carrying what looked like a bicycle without wheels, but with flimsy, almost gossamer-like wings. There was music for her, too. If it was the Sri Lankan anthem, that was news to Ranjit, who hadn't known there was one. But it was almost drowned out by the yells of the spectators on her side of the tube. The yelling kept up while the handlers attached the racers to their machines, Piper Dugan suspended from his hydrogen tank with his hands and feet free to pedal, Natasha seated at a 45-degree angle on the saddle of her sky bike. The music stopped. The yelling dwindled away. There was a moment of near silence, and then the sharp crack of the starter's pistol. At first, Dugan's blimp surged horizontally forward while Natasha's sky bike dropped half a dozen meters before she could get it up to speed. Then she began to overtake her competitor. It was a neck-and-neck race almost to the end of the stadium, with both flyers being loudly cheered by everybody. And not just the handful of spectators in the tube, but by the tens and hundreds of millions watching wherever in the solar system a human being possessed a screen. 20 meters from the finish line, Natasha passed her opponent. When she crossed the line, it was no longer even close, and the howling, screaming, and shouting noises of the 1,800 spectators in the tube was quite the loudest sound the moon had heard in many a long year. The trip back to Earth was quite as long and quite as restricted as the journey up, but at least they had Natasha with them this time, and Natasha had her rewards of victory. Those were quite impressive when you added them up. It seemed that her personal screen never darkened, with messages of congratulations from basically everyone she knew, as well as a very large number of people she didn't. The presidents of Russia, China, and the United States were among her well-wishers, not to mention the leaders of nearly every other country in the United Nations. And Dr. Dattusena Bandara, on behalf of Pax Per Fidem, and just about every one of her old teachers and friends and parents of friends. And the ones she really cared about, too, such as Beatrix Voorhoost and her whole domestic staff. And that is without mentioning the ones who wanted something from her. News programs seeking interviews, representatives of several dozen movements and charities begging for an endorsement. Not least, the International Olympic Committee itself was promising their new champion a place in the planned solar sail spacecraft race to be held as soon as enough viable solar sail spaceships existed in LEO and could be spared from the urgent work of settling the solar system. "Now that's because they're getting more pressure from the Big Three, I'll bet," Myra informed her family. "They want to get everything going at once for their own purposes." Her husband patted her shoulder. "And what purposes are those?" he asked tolerantly. "According to you, they already own just about everything." Myra wrinkled her nose at him. "You'll see," she said, though what it was he would see, she did not say. They were nearly to the upper Van Allen before the volume of calls dropped low enough for their traveling companions to catch up on some of their own neglected calls home. This time there were 16 others sharing their capsule, two wealthy Bulgarian families, though what their wealth came from Ranjit had not been quite able to identify, and a handful of almost as wealthy Canadians. In their case, the cash cow was petroleum from the Athabasca and tar sands. Ranjit felt an obligation to apologize to their fellow passengers for Natasha's hogging of the communications circuits. They were having none of that, though. "Bless her," said the oldest of the Canadian women. "Things like this don't come often in a young girl's life. Anyway, the news channels stayed open. Mostly that rash of new flying saucer stories. But did you hear about Egypt and Kenya? The Subramanians had not. And when they did, they were as delighted as any other. Kenya and Egypt had not only agreed on fairly sharing Nile water, but both countries, by a suddenly called plebiscite, had voted to join the Transparency Compact voluntarily.
"But that's very good," Ranjit said.
However, just then the shrill radiation warnings sounded, and it was time for them to get into the shelter once more. Ranjit sighed and led the way, followed by Natasha in conversation with one of the Canadian girls and his wife, with Robert by the hand. It took several minutes for all 20 of them to check out their bunks, with the warning whistle sounding all the time, and while Myra was fluffing up their pitiful excuse for a pillow, she stopped, looked around, and then demanded, "Where's Robert?" The answer came from one of the Canadians. "He was standing by the door a minute ago," she said. She didn't have to say anything more. Ranjit was already out of that door himself, shouting Robert's name above the screeching warnings. It didn't take him long to find his son, interestedly gazing out of the window at the polychrome blur that was the Van Allen belt, and not even that long to drag him back inside the shelter, slamming the door behind them. "He's all right," he reassured his family, and the others all worriedly gathered around the door together as well. "I asked him what the hell he thought he was doing, and he just said, 'Fish.'" Among all the sounds of amused relief, it was the Canadian grandmother who pursed her lips. "Was he saying he thought he saw a fish?" she asked. "Because it was on the news that other people have seen things from the skyhook, metallic sorts of things, kind of pointy at both ends. I guess you could say that might look like a fish." "The same things they've been claiming people saw all over," her son-in-law confirmed. "I thought it was all just another of those crazy things people get themselves into, but I don't know. I guess it's possible they could be real." And at that same time, those quite real 9 limbs in their little canoe-shaped craft were having a great debate. The decision to turn off the vision-deflecting shields so these Earth primitives could actually see them had seemed like a good idea at the time. Having done it, the 9 limbs were all trying to talk at once over the tight-beam network that allowed them to communicate without being overheard by the humans on the ground. And there was only one subject for discussion. Had they done the right thing? In order to try to answer that, the standing orders were refreshed and restored to visibility and studied by all. The experts in communications between the 9 limbs and the Grand Galactics meditated for prolonged periods before issuing an opinion. Since they had been trained from whelping to understand every nuance of every instruction ever handed down by the Grand Galactics, their opinions were listened to attentively, and their findings were nearly unanimous. Expressed in the sort of terms a human lawyer might use, they were these. The Grand Galactics had flatly forbidden the 9 limbs to enter into communication with the rogue race of humans. They had not, however, ordered them to take any care to see that humans didn't suspect their presence. Accordingly, the experts reasoned that the Grand Galactics could not, in justice, punish the 9 limbs very severely for what they had done. And, the experts concurred, the record was clear that the Grand Galactics did have some concept of justice, or of something somewhat like it. So they might reprimand, they might even punish, but it was highly unlikely that they would respond by exterminating the entire 9-limbed race. Other client races of the Grand Galactics wouldn't ever have taken that sort of chance in the first place. The 1.5s wouldn't have. Neither would the machine stored. Not one of the Grand Galactic's subject races had that keen a sense of humor, nor had ever dared such a transgression. Up until that point, that is. Chapter 33 Private Pain in a Rejoicing World. The Nile waters might never threaten the world's peace again, because both Egypt and Kenya passed the Pax per fidem vote with resounding margins. Even before Pax's peacekeepers were in place, teams of Kenyan hydrologists had begun setting up shop in the control buildings around the Aswan High Dam, and both countries had opened their, rather puny, missile sites to international control. Transparency of their heavy industry, such as it was, followed quickly. They were not the last, either. The four countries in sub-Saharan Africa that had been contesting the waters of one medium-sized lake saw what became of the one of their number that had sent a force to drive the other three away. When that one, properly warned, heedless of the warning, tasted silent thunder for itself, all three of the others joined the first in the contract. And then there was a major breakthrough. The Republic of Germany debated and argued and finally held a giant plebiscite of its own. Their terrible national memories of huge and violent lost battles trumped that sometimes troublesome German sense of destiny. They, too, signed up. They threw their borders open to the United Nations, disbanded the token armed forces they had retained, and signed on to Pax Perfidem's draft constitution for the world. Those were times for rejoicing for the people of planet Earth. There were only two things that dampened the joys of, say, the Subramanian family. The first was the one they shared with the whole human race, namely those pesky little apparitions that kept showing themselves in cities at night, in the air above sea-going vessels, in broad daylight, even, perhaps like young Robert's fish, in space. Some people called them bronzed bananas, some flying midget submarines, some by names a lot less printable. What no one knew was exactly what they were. The devout UFOologists called them the final proof that flying saucers were real. The hardened skeptics suspected that one or more of Earth's sovereign states was developing a mystery weapon unlike anything that had gone before. What everyone agreed on, however, was that none of these objects had done any human being any detectable harm. So comedians began joking about them, and human beings have never been able to be very afraid of things they laugh at. But for the Subramanian family, at least, there was this one other thing. Earlier than most, little Robert had begun walking on his own, but since they'd come back from the moon, his parents had noticed something odd. The whole family would be enjoying that happy playtime between baths and bed. Little Robert would let go of his mother's knee to wander over to where his big sister was coaxing him on. And then some